Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005, and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So you could just see
600,000 deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they sat me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you're finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking, They messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Frank.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarion. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarion took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarion, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Hi folks, in this video I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, It cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions. And that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills. And then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
All right, today we're going to talk about paradigm and paradigm shifts. What is a paradigm? What are paradigm shifts? Paradigm business models, matching daily habits, and action steps to take, paradigm comfort zones, monomania, and what is a monomaniac? And, you know, we're coming into the fourth quarter this year. Well, it is the fourth quarter, October, November. We're in the fourth quarter. So some of you, let's dust off those New Year's resolutions or goals or whatever you want to call them. And you might figure, oh, man, I'm not where I thought I would be. That's okay. You might have to, you need a paradigm shift, but before you do that, you need to know what a paradigm is. Now, you can also say a philosophy, but unless I'm going to narrow this down, and it could be anything. It could be for weight loss, weight gain, relationship status, career status, or whatever. I'm going to narrow it down to something what I consider simple. Money. You know, how many of you out there could use an extra $1,000 per day? Not per month. $5,000 per day. Or what about $10,000 per day? All right, well, let's go with the lowest number here, $1,000 a day. You know, because some people, you know, $100 a day, and they're happy campers. Some people, $100 a day is not enough. So let's go with the figure of $1,000 a day, and you've never earned that type of money on a consistent daily basis. Okay, so what paradigm would you have to which is a model, what belief system would you have to have? How would you have to adjust your self-image? And what daily habits, that might be the easiest thing to do and the least complicated, what daily habits would you need to acquire? You know what, just act on. What daily habits would it take you to earn $1,000 a day? All right. So let me see here. Oh, that's not what I want. Let's see. Let's play this. We're going to come back. What do you need to do? What action steps do you need to take to earn $1,000 a day? We're going to be right back with that.
This audio presentation of James Allen as a Man Thinketh is brought to you by AudioEnlightenment.com. Copyright 2011. All rights reserved. As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. Introduction. Mind is the master power that molds and makes, and man is mind and evermore he takes. The tool of thought in shaping what he wills brings forth 1,000 joys, 1,000 ills. He thinks in secret, and it comes to pass. Environment is but his looking glass. This little volume, the result of meditation and experience, is not intended as an exhaustive treatise on the much written about subject of the power of thought. It is suggestive rather than explanatory. Its object being to stimulate men and women to the discovery and perception of the truth that they themselves are makers of themselves by virtues of the thoughts which they choose and encourage. that mind is the master weaver, both of the inner garment of character and the outer garment of circumstance, and that, as they may have hitherto woven in ignorance and pain, they may now weave in enlightenment and happiness. James Allen. Chapter 1. Thought and Character. The aphorism, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he," not only embraces the whole of a man's being, but is so comprehensive as to reach out to every condition and circumstance of his life. A man is literally what he thinks, his character being the complete sum of all his thoughts. As the plant springs from, and could not be without, the seed, so every act of man springs from the hidden seeds of thought, and could not have appeared without them. This applies equally to those acts called spontaneous and unpremeditated, as to those which are deliberately executed. Act is the blossom of thought, and joy and suffering are its fruit. Thus does a man garner in the sweet and bitter fruitage of his own husbandry. Man is a growth by law, and not a creation by artifice. And cause and effect are as absolute and undeviating in the hidden realm of thought as in the world of visible and material things. A noble and godlike character is not a thing of favor or chance, but is the natural result of continued efforts in right thinking. The effect of long-cherished association with godlike thoughts. An ignoble and bestial character, by the same process, is the result of the continued harboring of groveling thoughts. Man is made or unmade by himself. In the armory of thought, he forges the weapons by which he destroys himself. He also fashions the tools with which he builds for himself heavenly mansions of joy, strength, and peace. By the right choice and true application of thought, man ascends to the divine perfection. By the abuse and wrong application of thought, he descends below the level of the beast. Between these two extremes are all the grades of character, and man is their maker and master. Of all the beautiful thoughts and truths pertaining to the soul which have been restored and brought to light in this age, none is more gladdening or fruitful of divine promise and confidence than this, that man is the master of thought, the molder of character, and the maker and shaper of condition, environment, and destiny. As a being of power, intelligence, and love, and the lord of his own thoughts, man holds keys to every situation, and contains within himself that transforming and regenerative agency by which he may make himself what he wills. Man is always the master, even in his weakest and most abandoned state. But in his weakness and degradation, he is a foolish master who misgoverns his household. When he begins to reflect upon his condition and search diligently for the law upon which his being is established, he then becomes the wise master, directing his energies with intelligence and fashioning his thoughts to fruitful issues. Such is the conscious master, and man can only thus become by discovering within himself the laws of thought. This discovery is totally a matter of application, self-analysis, and experience. Only by much searching and mining are gold and diamonds obtained, and man can find every truth connected with his being if he will dig deep into the mine of his soul. That he is the maker of his character, the molder of his life, and the builder of his destiny, he may unerringly prove if he will watch, control, and alter his thoughts, tracing their effects upon himself, upon others, and upon his life and circumstance, linking cause and effect by patient practice and investigation, and utilizing his every experience, even the most trivial everyday occurrence, as a means of obtaining that knowledge of himself, which is understanding, wisdom, power. In this direction is the law of absolute, that he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. For only by patience, practice, and ceaseless importunity can a man enter the door of the temple of knowledge.
I'd like to tell you about the strangest secret in the world. Some years ago, the late Nobel Prize-winning Dr. Albert Schweitzer was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him, "Doctor, what's wrong with men today?" And the great doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, "Men simply don't think." It's about this that I want to talk with you. We live today in a golden age. This is an era that man has looked forward to, dreamed of, and worked toward for thousands of years. But since it's here, we pretty well take it for granted. We in America are particularly fortunate to live in the richest land that ever existed on the face of the earth, a land of abundant opportunity for everyone. But do you know what happens? Well, let's take 100 men who start even at the age of 25. Do you have any idea what will happen to those men by the time they're 65? These 100 men who all start even at the age of 25 believe they're going to be successful. If you asked any one of these men if he wanted to be a success, he'd tell you he did. And you'd notice that he was eager toward life, that there was a certain sparkle to his eye, an erectness to his carriage, and life seemed like a pretty interesting adventure to him. But by the time they're 65, one will be rich. Four will be financially independent. Five will still be working. 54 will be broke. Now think a moment. Out of the 100, only five make the grade. Now why do so many fail? What has happened to the sparkle that was there when they were 25? What's become of the dreams, the hopes, the plans? And why is there such a large disparity between what these men intended to do and what they actually accomplished? When we say about 5% achieve success, we have to define success. And here's the best definition I've ever been able to find. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Rollo May, the distinguished psychiatrist, wrote a wonderful book called Man's Search for Himself. And in this book, he says, the opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice. It is conformity. And there you have the trouble today. It's conformity, people acting like everyone else without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. Now think of it. In America right now, there are over 18 million people 65 years of age and older. And most of them are broke. They're dependent on someone else for life's necessities. Now, we learn to read by the time we're 7. We learn to make a living by the time we're 25. Usually by that time, we're not only making a living, we're supporting a family. And yet, by the time we're 65, we haven't learned how to become financially independent in the richest land that has ever been known. Why? We conform. And the trouble is that we're acting like the wrong percentage group, the 95 who don't succeed. Now, why do these people conform? Well, they really don't know. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. They're outer-directed people. A survey was made one time that covered a lot of men, working men, and these men were asked, why do you work? Why do you get up in the morning? 19 out of 20 had no idea. If you ask them, they'll say, well, everyone goes to work in the morning, and that's the reason they do it, because everyone else is doing it. Now, let's get back to our definition of success. Who succeeds? The only person who succeeds is the person who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the person who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. I'll tell you who the successful people are. A success is the school teacher who's teaching school because that's what he or she wants to do. The success is the woman who's a wife and mother because she wanted to become a wife and mother and is doing a good job of it. The success is the man who runs the corner gas station because that was his dream. That's what he wanted to do. The success is the successful salesman who wants to become a top-notch salesman and grow and build with his organization. A success is anyone who is doing deliberately a predetermined job because that's what he decided to do deliberately. But only one out of 20 does that. That's why today there isn't really any competition unless we make it for ourselves. Instead of competing, all we have to do is create. You know, for 20 years, I looked for the key which would determine what would happen to a human being. Was there a key I wanted to know which would make the future a promise that we could foretell to a large extent? Was there a key that would guarantee a person's becoming successful if he only knew about it and knew how to use it? Well, there is such a key, and I've found it. Have you ever wondered why so many men work so hard and honestly without ever achieving anything in particular? And others don't seem to work hard and yet seem to get everything? They seem to have the magic touch. You've heard them say that about someone. Everything he touches turns to gold. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful? And on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who's a failure tends to continue to fail? Well, it's because of goals. Some of us have goals, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. It's that simple. Think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it'll take. It has a definite goal. Now, 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now, let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it'll either sink or wind up on some deserted beach or derelict. It can't go anyplace because it has no destination and no guidance, and it's the same with a human being. Take the salesman, for example. There's no other person in the world today with the future of a good salesman. Selling is the world's highest paid profession, if we're good at it and if we know where we're going. Every company needs top-notch salesmen, and they reward those men. The sky's the limit for them. But how many can you find? Someone once said the human race is fixed, not to prevent the strong from winning, but to prevent the weak from losing. The American economy today can be likened to a convoy in time of war. The entire economy is slowed down to protect its weakest link, just as the convoy had to go at the speed that would permit its slowest vessel to remain in formation. That's why it's so easy to make a living today. It takes no particular brains or talent to make a living and support a family today. So we have a plateau of so-called security, if that's what a person's looking for. But we do have to decide how high above this plateau we want to aim. Now let's get back to the strangest secret in the world, the story that I wanted to tell you today. Why do men with goals succeed in life and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You will suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line, and from now on you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success and the key to failure. We become what we think about. Now, let me say that again. We become what we think about. Throughout all history, the great wise men and teachers, philosophers and prophets have disagreed with one another on many different things. It's only on this one point that they are in complete and unanimous agreement. Listen to what Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor, said. A man's life is what his thoughts make of it. Disraeli said this. Everything comes if a man will only wait. I've brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment. Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, a man is what he thinks about all day long. William James said, the greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind. And he also said, we need only in cold blood act as if the thing in question were real, and it will become infallibly real by growing into such a connection with our life that it will become real. It will become so knit with habit and emotion that our interests in it will be those which characterize belief. And he also said, if you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. If you wish to be rich, you will be rich. If you wish to be learned, you will be learned. If you wish to be good, you will be good. Only you must then really wish these things and wish them exclusively and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly. In the Bible, you read in Mark 9:23, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. My old friend Dr. Norman Vincent Peale put it this way. This is one of the greatest laws in the universe. Fervently do I wish I had discovered it as a very young man. It dawned upon me much later in life, and I found it to be one of the greatest, if not my greatest, discovery outside of my relationship to God. The great law, briefly and simply stated, is that if you think in negative terms, you will get negative results. If you think in positive terms, you will achieve positive results. That is the simple fact, he went on to say, which is at the basis of an astonishing law of prosperity and success. In three words, believe and succeed. William Shakespeare put it this way, our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt. George Bernard Shaw said, people are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them. Well, it's pretty apparent, isn't it? And every person who discovered this for a while believed that he was the first one to work it out. We become what we think about. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about, and we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration and fear and anxiety and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now, how does it work? Why do we become what we think about? Well, I'll tell you how it works, as far as we know. Now, to do this, I want to tell you about a situation that parallels the human mind. Suppose a farmer has some land, and it's good, fertile land. Now, the land gives the farmer a choice. He may plant in that land whatever he chooses. The land doesn't care. It's up to the farmer to make the decision. Now, remember, we're comparing the human mind with the land because the mind, like the land, doesn't care what you plant in it. It will return what you plant, but it doesn't care what you plant. Now, let's say that the farmer has two seeds in his hand. One is a seed of corn. The other is nightshade, a deadly poison. He digs two little holes in the earth, and he plants both seeds, one corn, the other nightshade. He covers up the holes, waters, and takes care of the land, and what will happen? Invariably, the land will return what's planted. As it's written in the Bible, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Now remember, the land doesn't care. It'll return poison in just as wonderful abundance as it will corn. So up come the two plants, one corn, one poison. Now the human mind is far more fertile, far more incredible and mysterious than the land, but it works the same way. It doesn't care what we plant. Success, failure. A concrete, worthwhile goal, or confusion. Misunderstanding, fear, anxiety, and so on. But what we plant, it must return to us. You see, the human mind is the last great unexplored continent on earth. It contains riches beyond our wildest dreams. It will return anything we want to plant. Now, you might say, well, if that's true, why don't people use their minds more? Well, I think they figured out an answer to that one, too. Our mind comes as standard equipment at birth. It's free, and things that are given to us for nothing, we place little value on. Things that we pay money for, we value. The paradox is that exactly the reverse is true. Everything that's really worthwhile in life came to us free. Our minds, our souls, our bodies, our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions, our intelligence, our love of family and children and friends and country, all these priceless possessions are free. But the things that cost us money are actually very cheap and can be replaced at any time. A good man can be completely wiped out and make another fortune. He can do that several times. Even if our home burns down, we can rebuild it. But the things we got for nothing, we can never replace. The human mind isn't used because we take it for granted. Familiarity breeds contempt. It can do any kind of job we assign to it, but generally speaking, we use it for little jobs instead of big, important ones. Universities have proved that most of us are operating on about 10% or less of our abilities. So decide now. What is it you want? Plant your goal in your mind. It's the most important decision you ever make in your entire life. What is it you want? Do you want to be an outstanding salesman? A better worker at your particular job? Do you want to go places in your company? In your community? Do you want to get rich? All you've got to do is plant that seed in your mind, care for it, work steadily toward your goal, and it will become a reality. It not only will, there's no way that it cannot. You see, that's a law, like the laws of Sir Isaac Newton, the laws of gravity. If you get on top of a building and jump off, you'll always go down. You'll never go up, and it's the same with all the other laws of nature. They always work. They're inflexible. Think about your goal in a relaxed, positive way. Picture yourself in your mind's eye as having already achieved this goal. See yourself doing the things you will be doing when you've reached your goal. Ours has been called the phenobarbital age, the age of ulcers and nervous breakdowns and tranquilizers, at a time when medical research has raised us to a new plateau of good health and longevity. Far too many of us worry ourselves into an early grave, trying to cope with things in our own little personal ways, without learning a few great laws that will take care of everything for us. These things we bring on ourselves through our habitual way of thinking. Every one of us is the sum total of his own thoughts. He is where he is because that's exactly where he really wants to be, whether he'll admit that or not. Each of us must live off the fruit of his thoughts in the future, because what you think today and tomorrow, next month and next year, will mold your life and determine your future. You're guided by your mind. I remember one time I was driving through eastern Arizona, and I saw one of those giant earth-moving machines roaring along the road at about 35 miles an hour with what looked like 30 tons of dirt in it, a tremendous, incredible machine, and there was a little man perched way up on top with the wheel in his hands guiding it. And as I drove along, I was struck by the similarity of that machine to the human mind. Just suppose you're sitting at the controls of such a vast source of energy. Are you going to sit back and fold your arms and let it run itself into a ditch? Or are you going to keep both hands firmly on the wheel and control and direct this power to a specific, worthwhile purpose? It's up to you. You're in the driver's seat. You see, the very law that gives us success is a two-edged sword. We must control our thinking. The same rule that can lead a man to a life of success, wealth, happiness, and all the things he ever dreamed of for himself and his family. That very same law can lead him into the gutter. It's all in how he uses it, for good or for bad. This is the strangest secret in the world. Now, why do I say it's strange, and why do I call it a secret? Actually, it isn't a secret at all. It was first promulgated by some of the earliest wise men, and it appears again and again throughout the Bible. But very few people have learned it, understand it. That's why it's strange, and why, for some equally strange reason, it virtually remains a secret. I believe that you could go out and walk down the main street of your town and ask one man after another what the secret of success is, and you probably wouldn't run into one man in a month who could tell you. Now, this information is enormously valuable to us if we really understand it and apply it. It's valuable to us not only for our own lives, but the lives of those around us, our families, employees, associates, and friends. Life should be an exciting adventure. It should never be a bore. A man should live fully, be alive. He should be glad to get out of bed in the morning. He should be doing a job he likes to do because he does it well. One time I heard Grove Patterson, the great late editor-in-chief of the Toledo Daily Blade, make a speech, and as he concluded his speech, he said something I've never forgotten. He said, "My years in the newspaper business have convinced me of several things. Among them, that people are basically good, and that we came from someplace and we're going someplace. So we should make our time here an exciting adventure. The architect of the universe didn't build a stairway leading nowhere." And the greatest teacher of all, the carpenter from the plains of Galilee, gave us the secret time and time again. As ye believe, so shall it be done unto you. I've explained the strangest secret in the world and how it works. Now, on this side, I want to explain how you can prove to yourself the enormous returns possible in your own life by putting this secret to a practical test. I want you to make a test that will last 30 days. It isn't going to be easy, but if you'll give it a good try, it will completely change your life for the better. Now, back in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician and natural philosopher, gave us some natural laws of physics which apply as much to human beings as they do to the movement of bodies in the universe. And one of these laws is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Simply stated, as it applies to you and me, it means we can achieve nothing without paying the price. The results of your 30-day experiment will be in direct proportion to the effort you put forth. To be a doctor, you must pay the price of long years of difficult study. To be successful in selling, and remember that each of us succeeds to the extent of his ability to sell, selling our families on our ideas, selling education in schools, selling our children on the advantages of living the good and honest life, selling our associates and employees on the importance of being exceptional people, to, of course, the profession of selling itself. But to be successful in selling our way to the good life, we must be willing to pay the price. Now, what is that price? Well, it's many things. First, it's understanding emotionally, as well as intellectually, that we literally become what we think about, that we must control our thoughts if we're to control our lives. It's understanding fully that as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Second, it's cutting away all fetters from the mind and permitting it to soar as it was divinely designed to do. It's the realization that your limitations are self-imposed and that the opportunities for you today are enormous beyond belief. It's rising above narrow-minded pettiness and prejudice. And third, it's using all your courage to force yourself to think positively on your own problem, to set a definite and clearly defined goal for yourself, to let your marvelous mind think about your goal from all possible angles, to let your imagination speculate freely upon many different possible solutions, to refuse to believe that there are any circumstances sufficiently strong to defeat you in the accomplishment of your purpose, to act promptly and decisively when your course is clear, and to keep constantly aware of the fact that you are, at this moment, standing in the middle of your own acres of diamonds, as Russell Conwell used to point out. And fourth, save at least 10% of every dollar you earn. It's also remembering that no matter what your present job, it has enormous possibilities if you're willing to pay the price. Now let's just go over the important points in the price each of us must pay to achieve the wonderful life that can be ours. It is, of course, worth any price. 1. You will become what you think about. 2. Remember the word imagination and let your mind begin to soar. 3. Courage. Concentrate on your goal every day. 4. Save 10% of what you earn. And 5. Action. Ideas are worthless unless we act on them. Now, I'll try to outline the 30-day test I want you to make. Keep in mind that you have nothing to lose by making this test and everything you could possibly want to gain. There are two things that may be said of everyone. Each of us wants something, and each of us is afraid of something. I want you to write on a card what it is you want more than anything else. It may be more money. Perhaps you'd like to double your income or make a specific amount of money. It may be a beautiful home. It may be success at your job. It may be a particular position in life. It could be a more harmonious family. Each of us wants something. Now write down on your card specifically what it is you want. Make sure it's a single goal and clearly defined. You needn't show it to anyone, but carry it with you so that you can look at it several times a day. Think about it in a cheerful, relaxed, positive way each morning when you get up. And immediately you have something to work for, something to get out of bed for, something to live for. Look at it every chance you get during the day and just before going to bed at night. And as you look at it, remember that you must become what you think about, and since you're thinking about your goal, you realize that soon it will be yours. In fact, it's yours really the moment you write it down and begin to think about it. Look at the abundance all around you as you go about your daily business. You have as much right to this abundance as any other living creature. It's yours for the asking. Now we come to the difficult part. Difficult because it means the formation of what is probably a brand new habit, and new habits are not easily formed. Once formed, however, it will follow you for the rest of your life. Stop thinking about what it is you fear. Each time a fearful or negative thought comes into your consciousness, replace it with a mental picture of your positive and worthwhile goal. And there'll come times when you'll feel like giving up. It's easier for a human being to think negatively than positively. That's why only 5% are successful. You must begin now to place yourself in that group. For 30 days, you must take control of your mind. It will think about only what you permit it to think about. Each day for this 30-day test, do more than you have to do. In addition to maintaining a cheerful, positive outlook, give of yourself more than you've ever done before. Do this knowing that your returns in life must be in direct proportion to what you give. The moment you decide on a goal to work toward, you're immediately a successful person. You are then in that rare and successful category of people who know where they're going. Out of every 100 people, you belong to the top 5. Don't concern yourself too much with how you're going to achieve your goal. Leave that completely to a power greater than yourself. All you have to do is know where you're going. The answers will come to you of their own accord and at the right time. Remember these words from the Sermon on the Mount, and remember them well. Keep them constantly before you this month of your test. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth. And he that seeketh, findeth. And to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. It's as marvelous and as simple as that. In fact, it's so simple that in our seemingly complicated world, it's difficult for an adult to understand it. All he needs is a purpose and faith. for 30 days, do your very best. If you're a salesman, go at it as you've never done before, not in a hectic fashion, but with the calm, cheerful assurance that time well spent will give you the abundance in return you deserve and want. If you're a homemaker, devote your 30-day test to completely giving of yourself without thinking about receiving anything in return, and you'll be amazed at the difference it makes in your life. No matter what your job, do it as you've never done it before for 30 days. And if you've kept your goal before you every day, you'll wonder and marvel at this new life you've found. Dorothea Brand, the outstanding editor and writer, discovered it for herself and tells about it in her fine book, Wake Up and Live. Her entire philosophy is reduced to the words, act as though it were impossible to fail. She made her own test with sincerity and faith, and her entire life was changed to one of overwhelming success. Now, you make your test for 30 full days. Don't start your test until you've made up your mind to stick with it. You see, by being persistent, you're demonstrating faith. Persistence is simply another word for faith. If you didn't have faith, you'd never persist. If you should fail during your first 30 days, by that I mean suddenly find yourself overwhelmed by negative thoughts, you've got to start over again from that point and go 30 more days. Gradually, your new habit will form until you find yourself one of that wonderful minority to whom virtually nothing is impossible. And don't forget the card. It's vitally important as you begin this new way of living. On one side of the card, write your goal, whatever it may be. On the other side, write the words we've quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Nothing great was ever accomplished without inspiration. See that during these crucial first 30 days, your own inspiration is kept at a peak. And above all, don't worry. Worry brings fear, and fear is crippling. The only thing that can cause you to worry during your test is trying to do it all yourself. Know that all you have to do is hold your goal before you. Everything else will take care of itself. Remember also to keep calm and cheerful. Don't let petty things annoy you and get you off course. Now, since making this test is difficult, some will say, why should I bother? Well, look at the alternative. No one wants to be a failure. No one really wants to be a mediocre individual. No one wants a life constantly filled with worry and fear and frustration. Therefore, remember that you must reap that which you sow. If you sow negative thoughts, your life will be filled with negative things. If you sow positive thoughts, your life will be cheerful, successful, and positive. Now, gradually, you will have a tendency to forget what you've heard on this recording. Play it often. Keep reminding yourself of what you must do to form this new habit. Gather your whole family around at regular intervals and listen to what's been said here. You know, most men will tell you that they want to make money without understanding the law. The only people who make money work in a mint. The rest of us must earn money. This is what causes those who keep looking for something for nothing or a free ride to fail in life. The only way to earn money is by providing people with services or products which are needed and useful. We exchange our time and our product or service for the other man's money. Therefore, the law is that our financial return will be in direct proportion to our service. Now, success is not the result of making money. Making money is the result of success, and success is in direct proportion to our service. Most people have this law backwards. They believe that you're successful if you earn a lot of money. The truth is that you can only earn money after you're successful. It's like the story of the man who sat in front of the stove and said to it, give me heat, and then I'll add the wood. How many men and women do you know, or do you suppose there are today, who take the same attitude toward life? There are millions. We've got to put the fuel in before we can expect heat. Likewise, we've got to be of service first before we can expect money. Don't concern yourself with the money. Be of service. Build, work, dream, create. Do this and you'll find there's no limit to the prosperity and abundance that will come to you. Prosperity, you know, is founded upon a law of mutual exchange. Any person who contributes to prosperity must prosper in turn himself. Sometimes the return will not come from those you serve, but it must come to you from someplace, because that's the law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. As you go daily through your 30-day test period, remember that your success will always be measured by the quality and quantity of service you render, and money is a yardstick for measuring this service. No man can get rich himself unless he enriches others. Now, there are no exceptions to a law. You can drive down any street in America and from your car estimate the service that's being rendered by the people living on that street. Had you ever thought of this yardstick before? It's interesting. Some, like ministers and priests and other devoted people, measure their returns in the realm of the spiritual. But again, their returns are equal to their service. Once this law is fully understood, any thinking person can tell his own fortune. If he wants more, he must be of more service to those from whom he receives his return. If he wants less, he has only to reduce his service. This is the price you must pay for what you want. If you believe you can enrich yourself by deluding others, you can end only by deluding yourself. It may take some time, but just as surely as you breathe, you'll get back what you put out. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking you can avert this. It's impossible. The prisons and the streets for the lonely walk are filled with people who tried to make new laws just for themselves. We may avoid the laws of man for a while, but there are greater laws that cannot be broken. An outstanding medical doctor recently pointed out 6 steps that will help you realize success. 1. Set yourself a definite goal. 2. Quit running yourself down. 3. Stop thinking of all the reasons why you cannot be successful and instead think of all the reasons why you can. 4. Trace your attitudes back through your childhood and try to discover where you first got the idea you couldn't be successful, if that's the way you've been thinking. 5. Change the image you have of yourself by writing out a description of the person you would like to be. And 6. Act the part of the successful person you have decided to become. The doctor who wrote those words is a noted West Coast psychiatrist, Dr. David Harold Fink. Do what the experts since the dawn of recorded history have told you you must do. Pay the price by becoming the person you want to become. It's not nearly as difficult as living unsuccessfully. Make your 30-day test, then repeat it again, and each time it will become more a part of you until you'll wonder how you could ever have lived any other way. Live this new way and the floodgates of abundance will open and pour over you more riches than you may have dreamed existed. Money? Yes, lots of it. But what's more important, you'll have peace. You'll be in that wonderful minority who lead calm, cheerful, successful lives. Start today. You have nothing to lose, but you have a whole life to win. This is Earl Nightingale, and thank you.
about 170 homeless people who live in Delaware County, and some of them may be in line for a brand new tiny home.
A nonprofit group is planning to build the state's first village of tiny houses for the homeless. RTV6's Derek Thomas has that groundbreaking story.
The 696 square foot houses would be built in this area. They would have heat and electricity, but no indoor plumbing. The tiny houses would look similar to this house in Madison, Wisconsin. That city has had a program that caters to the homeless since 2014. The houses here would have a separate community building that would be constructed where this basketball court is, that would contain bathroom and shower facilities on one side and a kitchen facility on the other.
The hardest to house are normally people who are sleeping in the hospital waiting rooms, under the bridges. We want to get them in, engage them, get them into a private individual little unit that they can get used to living in more a societal area. And then the goal is to get them into permanent housing at the end of 12 months.
We talked to some homeless folks to see what they thought of such an arrangement.
I myself wouldn't be interested in it just because of the fact of the size of the building. And I'm at a point in my life now that I want to earn my way up. I don't want to be handed something else.
After being in an environment like a homeless shelter, I think it would be a good transition to get back into the real world. Sounds like a good thing.
It sounds like a good thing to Ruth Rector, who lives in the neighborhood where the tiny houses will be constructed.
It is very exciting because I feel so sorry for them when I see them walking down the street with everything they own on their back. You know, it makes me feel, oh my gosh, can I help this person?
There will be a hearing before the county zoning board on Thursday. If everything passes without a hitch, they hope to have people moving into the tiny houses by October 15th. In Muncie, Derek Thomas, RTV6.
Oregon sunshine. You got to admit, for, you know, going on the middle of December, though, it could be a lot worse. I know a lot of places that are in snow right now. This technically is a singles bungalow. This is one of the smaller ones. This is an 8x8 as opposed to ones like this over here, or this over here, that are doubles, you know.
Okay.
In we go. Big enough for two good friends to be able to sit in their chairs in the evening when they're not at the yurt or somewhere else, you know. It encourages you to get out more often, I guess you could say. And of course, the master bedroom upstairs here, in the loft. But then that job was farmed out overseas, you know, and so the employment opportunity ceased. At this point in time, it was like the sand going through the hourglass, you know. It was just a matter of time before we had to step out somewhere else, you know. We found out about Opportunity Village. I believe there was an article in one of the local newspapers about it. And I saw the outlay, the design of the place, and so we thought about checking it out.
If what's expected is you go straight from homeless to, you know, hey, go rent an apartment, that's a leap. That's not a step. You know, I was off and on homeless for 3 years. I was faced with this huge leap. And I mean, you bust your ass.
Eggs are donated, but unfortunately, they're usually broke or outdated, or so you have to be careful.
The smaller you can make the steps for homeless people to get off the streets, the easier it is.
If people are going to go looking for work, They need to be able to have a place where they can have a roof over their head, if at all possible. They need to be able to have a shower facility where they shower and be presentable to go out and work. There are 33, 34 people who live here in the village, and we share community eating areas, food preparation areas. And in any environment like this, you're going to have a number of different personalities.
Name on
I'm
it.
Trying.
We have our
yeah.
stuff in the kitchen with our name on it.
It doesn't apply in the laundry room. That is a community area, and everyone uses the laundry, and we don't have storage.
So it's a work in progress, a daily thing that the villagers just kind of have to be able to work within that framework of each other.
And I thought we had some sort of an understanding as to making people not feel alienated from being on those computers.
You know, what's good for one of us is good for all of us if we all work together towards the same thing. We're all in the same boat here.
I do think everyone's intentions, even if it's not to make themselves better, I believe they want to make this a better place to stay. And not for nothing, if they don't want this to be a better place to stay and they don't want to get better themselves, that should be the two rule breakers. If all you had to do is wake up in the morning, take a shower, work a 10-hour day, you got to come home, put your laundry in. While laundry's working, you could make a really nice dinner. That's not feasible when you're homeless. It's tough. And so, to me, this is a perfect scenario, you know, for people that want to actually, you know, again, use it as a stepping stone to move forward with their life.
The population of homeless are here in our county is, most of them are ours. They are, don't come from other places. We are a county as big as Connecticut. We have to think differently.
You can't drive down any street in America where you don't see people who are legitimately homeless, you know, and there's got to be a solution to that. The solutions have to be found, and solutions have to be worked on.
The smaller you can make the steps for homeless people to get off the streets, the easier it is. I'm in the perfect place for me right now. I can take care of my fines. I can take care of my child support. I can actually maybe get a full-time job, you know, get an apartment, you know, start, you know, getting my kids again. These are the things that motivate me. What I'm not willing to do is give up.
So can you imagine having to commute 3 hours to and then from your job every day? 6 hours of travel without even factoring your actual workday. Well, it is becoming more and more common. It's a phenomenon called supercommuting, and they don't mean that in a good way. And NBC News correspondent Jacob Soboroff saw it in full swing out in San Francisco. Watch this.
Every day at 4:23 p.m., Bernadette Price clocks out of her job at San Francisco University Medical Center to start her three-hour commute home.
And we're going to have exactly 3 minutes to get across that street.
Why do you have to do this?
Because it's too expensive to live here. We have to.
4:23 and 3 seconds.
Out.
We're out.
Let's
we're gone.
Go.
All right, here we go. So where are we going?
Cross street to the Injuda.
Okay, so we have to have our cards ready?
Yep.
All right, here we go. Do you ever miss it?
Yep. But I always run to the next stop.
So if we miss it, we got to run to the next.
You got
to
run, yep.
Bernadette, do you like doing this?
Nope, but it keeps me in shape.
It keeps you in shape.
To live close to where she works, Bernadette would have to fork over an extreme amount of cash.
Thank you.
So the apartments that I pass by every day that I decided to call and check on are these right here.
And what would you say, we're about 10 minutes from where you work at the hospital?
Yeah, $4,500 and a shady area.
In a studio apartment.
Yes. This is it.
Okay.
This is the West Oakland stop. What would it cost you to live here?
Those apartments are low-income apartments, and I don't qualify for those.
Because?
I make too much money.
Too much is $64,000 a year. because she's married with a 13-year-old son, who she races to pick up every day from football practice. Going round trip between San Francisco and Stockton sounds extreme, but it's becoming more common. 3% of all Americans are now so-called supercommuters, spending over 90 minutes getting to and from work. In Stockton, where Bernadette lives, that number is 8%.
So we only have an hour and a half to get to your son's football practice.
Dream that I make it.
Next stop, freeway?
Yep.
As I just look in the rearview mirror and I see the sun is setting, it occurred to me that you probably leave the house before the sun comes up and get to the house back home after the sun's gone down. This is our exit?
This is our exit coming up.
So we're looking for number 3?
Number 3. There you go. Hi, I'm EJ.
Nice to meet you, EJ. You guys want to go home?
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
All right.
What's it like to not be able to see your mom in the morning?
Kind of sad because I want to spend more time with her.
What's it like to hear him say that?
It's sad. I try to call him and wake him up every morning, say the motivational quote so that we can have a good day.
And what's the quote you say to each other?
I'm a leader, not a follower.
I'm a leader, not a follower.
And I will it to be a good day today.
Was today a good day?
Today yeah. was a good day. Got him on time. Always a good day if I get him on time.
Wow. Jacob Soboroff is with me now. Jacob, good morning.
Good morning.
Can I tell you, it really irritates me because here she is working so hard. Cops, firefighters, teachers, these are the ones having to do it while these tech giants make gazillions of dollars for, you know, working on a chip, which is fine. It's important. But why? Why should the people who actually keep the country running have to work that hard just to make from A to B?
It's a very good question that policymakers now across the country are having to deal with. In my opinion, the only people that should wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning are people that work in morning television, like you and myself. Bernadette, who I talked to this morning, told me, first she says hello, but she told me she woke up today at 3 o'clock, a little extra early, because she was going today with EJ to go to high school orientations. He's only 13 years old. She's trying to plan that far ahead. It just so happens that the people who help us the most in our everyday lives are the ones that struggle the most in this kind
they're
of
they're the ones getting the short end.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not even the doctors and the lawyers, although they're getting forced out too because of the cost of housing. It's the cost of housing. In San Francisco, medium home value is $1.293 million, almost $1.3 million. That's what she'd have to pay if she wants to buy a home there.
Right.
In Stockton it's $274,000. So, I mean, there's no question where you'd live.
And prices are going up in Stockton as well. People are no longer just going to the suburbs. They're going beyond the suburbs in order to be able to go back and work in the cities. And this is happening, I think, in 40 of the 50 states. Supercommuting has been on the rise. And in 30 of the 50 states, double-digit increases between, like, 2010 and 2015. It's out of control. And it's something, again, that in San Francisco, all throughout California, people are trying to figure out a way to get more affordable housing, and they're advocates, but they haven't been successful
there
yet.
Was something interesting proposed in Nantucket, right, about, like, subsidizing or putting, like, an extra tax on everybody's purchase.
Yeah, in order to pay for affordable housing. But people are always arguing, the people with the money, I don't want to pay additional taxes. I want to keep that money in my pocket.
Would you want a firefighter to show up if your house catches on fire?
He
can't do a three-hour commute. like that's the trade-off.
It's the exact point. We have to remember that these are the people that make our everyday lives possible. If you went to that hospital in San Francisco and Bernadette wasn't able to commute there, you wouldn't have somebody
I'll
that would care for your health.
Elon Musk is the solution. He says he's going to build some super rail that's going to get us from D.C. to New York in 29 minutes. It's going to be underground. He claimed that he had verbal approval from the Trump administration. We haven't seen any actual evidence of it, but yes.
I will ride it for you.
Okay, good. I believe that. We'll film it. Jacob, great
deal.
To see you.
Good to see you.
And all the best to Bernadette, too.
Hello, Today fans. Thanks for checking out our YouTube channel. Subscribe by clicking that button down there. And click on any of the videos over here to watch the latest interviews, show highlights, and digital exclusives.
Okay, today, as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, quick topic here, and we'll get into how we're doing this tomorrow specifically. Paradigm shifts. Now, first let's look up the word paradigm. Let's get the definition on it. And I'm online and you can look it up for your online paradigm is one definition from Wikipedia. In science and philosophy, a paradigm is a distinct set of concepts of or thoughts or thought patterns, including theories, research methods, postulates, and standards. Let's say here, then they say the types of paradigms. Positive paradigms, realism paradigms, critical theory paradigms. That's three. I want to get something simple here. All right, dictionary.com, let's see what they say. I'm trying to get a simplified definition of paradigm before we get to paradigm shift. Paradigm, according to dictionary.com, is a framework containing the basic assumptions, ways of thinking, and methodology that are commonly accepted by members of a scientific community. Let's see, another definition here is a general mental model or framework for anything. All right, let's see. Well, let's go with that one. A general mental model or framework for anything. So, as in the title that we have today, Paradigm and Paradigm Shifts. Now, from that last audio that we just played, where the supercommuter, all right, that, you know, they're spending 6 hours a day in transit going 3 hours to work, then they work the 8-hour work day, and then another 3-hour commute back home, all right? You have plenty of people doing that. Some people fly in. Some people take trains in. Some people drive in. Some people come in during the week and they go back home weekends. And some people have figured out, and that's their paradigm. That's their paradigm. In order for, if they want to collect, they can't afford to live, in this case, that's audio. They work in Silicon Valley because it gives a nice paycheck, but they can't afford to live in Silicon Valley because it'll, just gobble up that paycheck. So they work in Silicon Valley and they live 3 hours away. That's their paradigm. All right. Now there are other people who have a different paradigm. And let's say you're doing that, and then you discover, wait a minute, I can earn the same amount of money, but I don't have to. I don't have to go 3 hours. I don't have to do a 3-hour commute to do that. And once a person is open-minded towards that, they can have a paradigm shift. They can be remote workers, which you have a lot of people that work, their office is their phone, or phone and laptop, tablet, whatever they have. All right. Or you have some people that have multiple jobs where they don't have to commute at all. And there's some people, I forgot what you call them, but they might have 10 or 11 jobs, full-time jobs, but they don't have to commute. So that's a paradigm shift. And some of those people that are doing that are making $1 million plus a year. Now, we're going to take, and a paradigm shift is basically, I like to use philosophy. A paradigm shift is basically when your point of view and your philosophy changes on how to do something in particular. All right. You know, let's say the Great Migration of African Americans from the rural areas to the urbanized industrialized cities. All right, a lot of them had acres of land, but they didn't want to get up at 3:30, 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the morning to go feed the livestock and, you know, and do farm work. Although they had control, some had control of hundreds of acres of land, in some cases thousands of acres of land. But what lured them away from the country in part was, you know, the comfort and conveniences, you know, 9 to 5. Okay, being at work at 9 o'clock still beats getting up at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning. All right, to many people it did. The working, you know, 9 to 5, I mean, it 8 hours, so you're going to work during daylight hours, and during half the year, you're coming home before the sun goes down. All right. So a lot of people signed up for the 9 to 5 workshop. And then when you throw into things like the benefits and all that, you know, a lot of people went for that. And most people today, they go by that. But with a paradigm shift, which is happening now, now you've got gig workers that do Uber and Lyft. You work when you want to. And you work as long as you want to if you're doing a gig job, you know, delivering groceries, things of that nature. Or the people that might have 10 or 11 full-time jobs, but they work all of those jobs at home. Now, each and every one of those jobs might require a laptop. So they'll have 10 or 11, a laptop for each job. All right, so you have people out there, but the payoff is they don't have to worry about, they don't even need a car. Okay, if they need transportation, they can call up Uber or Lyft or somebody in their social network. So they don't have to worry about a car note, gasoline, brake jobs, lube jobs, transmission, you know, all that other stuff. So they don't have to worry about any of that, and they're clearing $1 million a year. You have people like that. They've gone through a paradigm shift. I mean, it's like the paradigm when I was coming up was go to school, good grades, get a good job. For some people, go to the military. All right. Now, you still have some people probably saying that, but I'm sure some people are saying go to school and start a business. Go to school and start a side hustle. Or, you know what, just go to YouTube and start something. So those are just different examples of paradigm shifts. So what we shall be doing tomorrow is this. We're going to explore the various ways that you can have a paradigm shift where you can start earning $1,000 a day. Now, we'll have models. And it's the same model that we do now. It's up to you. We got $1,000, $5,000, $10,000. You decide what paradigm shift that you want to switch up to, but we're going to start off with $1,000 per day. $1,000 per day, working Monday through Friday, every week for a month, that's $20,000 a month. That's doing a lot. The American worker doesn't make that kind of money. So we're going to go through the paradigm shifts. What paradigm model, what type of business model would you need, and what kind of daily habits would you need? We're going through that tomorrow. All right. So on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.
New Jersey's got a lot of historic wows, from Victorian beach towns to Revolutionary War battlegrounds. Explore wow after wow at more than 463 historic landmarks, in museums, lighthouses, and over 58 state and national parks. It's one wow after another, you get it. Find your wow at visitnj.org/history. New Jersey, little state, lot of wow.